Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, listening audience. Thank you for tuning in to Talk Straight and being a part of a national dialogue designed for proactive change. This is your host, Reverend Dr. Reuben Dockery. I'm grateful again to engage each and every one of you in very important conversation. I need your help as I endeavor to take this message and the conversation we share on air to targeted cities and urban areas across America with the hope and desire to improve the quality of lives by engaging communities and proactive strategies. You can be of great help by going to our webpage, www.bfcinstitute.com. Click on the donation tab or the contact us tab and find ways that you can assist us by either purchasing our items or just making a donation on our secure PayPal site. If you are a business or someone who would like to make a corporate level contribution and you would like more information, please give me a call at 615-498-4669 or send me an email at bfcinstitute@gmail.com. That's bfcinstitute@gmail.com, or give us a call at 615-498-4669. We are glad to share with you and provide you all the necessary information to help you make the decision to support us in our traveling lecture series. Welcome to another episode of Talk Straight. This is your host, Reverend Dr. Reuben Dockery. Grateful that you can join us tonight. We have another, I believe, informative conversation tonight. And if you ever wondered what led to the blight and degradation of certain urban neighborhoods and why they seem to be so trashed and how did buildings get tore up and things of that nature, well, tonight will be quite informative for you. I don't know if you know it, but tomorrow will be an anniversary that is very important to particularly African Americans. And again, this you'll find this a very informative dialogue. You can give us a call here live at the on air at 657-383-0944. We're always happy to entertain your question, your comments. All we ask is that you keep it relevant to our topic as much as possible anyway. And show a little deference for all of our callers. Sometimes we have varying opinions, and we respect everyone's input and their opinion, and we certainly respect yours. And we, again, encourage you to give us a call here. In case you're new to the show, I offer a monologue which provides context for our conversation tonight, and it'll be a point of reference for us. I'll be giving you a little background on tonight's topic, which is, the question is asked, has urban America recovered from Holy Week 1968? Holy Week 1968. All right. So, again, what we're going to be discussing tonight is the fact that on April 4th, 1968, 50 years ago, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee, on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel. Some things happened that night that I would argue have left a profound and lasting impact, not so much for the better, on young people today. And we see these things in current events in our society. But specifically as we focus here with building families and communities in our lecture series on at-risk African-American males across urban America, I think you'll see the relevance here. All right. Without getting too much, tonight what we're going to do is we're going to bring you in on a virtual conversation with Dr. Martin Luther King. Okay, we're going to hear from him tonight in his own words. but I'd like to get you to share as well. Nonetheless, without further ado, what I'm going to do now is go ahead. Again, the number is 657-383-0944. One last order of business. Pastor Waller will be with us. He may come in a little late. He's attending to some other matters, but he told me to go ahead, and he'll get here as soon as he can. But nonetheless, I want you to give us a call here and participate in the dialogue. That's what it's all about. I want to thank our Facebook friends for joining us. Let me do that. I'd be remiss not to say over the last few months or so, you've been kind enough to join us and to tune in to us and to view our episodes. And some of you have even commented. If you would like to do so, you can do so anonymously. You don't necessarily have to give your name, but we'll be happy to share your questions or comments live on air here. Professor Robson has been keeping up with us, and we appreciate him as well, and Ms. Rama as well. So having said that, we're going to I'm gonna tell the truth this time, and I'm going to get on to my monologue. All right. Again, tonight's topic is posed in the form of a question. Has urban America recovered from Holy Week 1968? And if you don't know what that is, I'm going to explain that now. Ephesians, the 4th chapter, in the 26th verse through the 28th verse reads, "Be ye angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down on your wrath. Neither give place to the devil. Let him that stole steal no more, but rather let him labor, working with his hands the things which is good, that he may have to give to him that needeth." Just 10 days before the national celebration of Easter, in April of 1968, was a period in American history that will forever be sketched in the minds of many, and rightfully so. It's known as the Holy Week Uprising. The Holy Week Uprising. A wave of civil disturbance which swept the United States following the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. on April 4, 1968, on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis, Tennessee. Now, the government recognizes this as the greatest wave of social unrest to hit the United States since the Civil War to date. We've seen a few in the last 5 years or so. But the government recognized this wave that we're making reference to. And incidentally, Thursday we're going to talk a little bit more about some other historical issues and so forth and so on. But to date, this particular wave in this week time, April 4th to April 14th, the greatest wave of unrest hit America. Some of the major riots that took place were in Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Maryland, Chicago, Illinois, and Kansas City, Missouri, while there were others, and we're going to talk about a few of them tonight. Now, interestingly enough, with great irony, Dr. King was not only the beloved leader of the civil rights movement itself, excellent orator, planner, strategist, so forth and so on, but he was an advocate for nonviolence. He was a symbol of direct engagement with the government and availing yourself to the political process in America. He wasn't really with some of the black nationalist ideas of separating and becoming independent. But he encouraged people, work within the government in which you are part of. For the most faithful followers of Dr. King, perhaps they were the most despondent after his death, and even they began to say, after being disillusioned and feeling the anger, violence perhaps is the only way to get white America's attention. I would argue with you, though, that it had the most long-lasting and negative effect on African Americans. Let's get into it. The rioters were mostly black, okay, and often people assume these were poor black people, but not all of them were poor. In fact, even middle-class individuals were so frustrated and angered by the loss of Dr. King that they participated as well in the rioting. Although the media framed it as race riots, when you look at the final report after the fact, there were few confirmed incidents of direct violence with blacks and whites. So it really didn't rise to the definition of a race riot. White businesses, tend to be targeted by many blacks. But interestingly enough, when it came to the public community buildings such as schools and churches and libraries, they were spared. In Ted Oza, it was mostly businesses and property, direct property of people in certain other, in the business arena primarily. Now, what I'd like to do is to run through just a few of these cities that were on fire during the Holy Week uprising, and I want to correlate them to what's going on today. Somehow, particularly African Americans, and I will reference Black Lives Matter and groups associated with it, there seems to be a misunderstanding of what it meant to protest versus to riot. There's a difference. If you're going to have a protest, and this is what Dr. King promoted, if you're going to have a protest, have a beginning and have an end and be able to measure success of your protest, as opposed to just rioting just for the heck of being mad and tearing something up. All right? So just bear with me a few minutes as I give you some examples. And listen to what's going on in these cities. And then we're going to come and listen to Brother Marvin Gaye. He was inspired to put a piece out that really capitalized this frustration, this anxiety, back in 1971. In Washington, D.C., as word of Dr. King's murder spread on the evening of April 4th, crowds began to gather on 14th and U Street. Brother Stokely Carmichael was there, and he led members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee to stores in the neighborhoods, and they demanded that those stores close themselves down, stop making money, out of respect for Dr. King. Although they were polite at first, the crowd fell out of control and began breaking windows. All it takes is one. By 11 p.m., widespread looting had begun. Mayor Walter Washington ordered the damage cleaned up immediately the next day. However, people weren't having it. Their anger still evident on Friday morning when Carmichael addressed at a rally at Howard, warning of violence. After the close of the rally, crowds walking down 7th Street and 8th Street corridor came into a violent confrontation with police. By midday, numerous buildings were on fire. Firefighters were prevented from responding to crowds, attacking them with bottles and rocks. Crowds of many as 20,000 people overwhelmed the district's 3,100-member police force. President Lyndon Baines Johnson dispatched 13,600 federal troops, including another 1,750 federalized D.C. National Guard troops to assist. Marines mounted machine guns on the steps of the state capitol, and armed troops in the 3rd Infantry guarded the White House. At one point on April 5th, rioting reached within 2 blocks of the White House itself until the rioters retreated. It's Sound like a war-torn country, doesn't it? In Chicago, meanwhile, on April 5th, 1968, violence sparked on the west side of the city and gradually expanded to consume a 28-block stretch west of Madison Street, with additional damage occurring in Roosevelt Road. The North Lawndale and East Garfield neighborhoods of the west side and the Woodlawn neighborhoods of the south side experienced the majority of destruction and chaos. Interestingly enough, West Lawndale is where most of the shootings and the killings in Chicago are taking place, in addition to the Woodlawn community of Inglewood. So today, 50 years later, they're still on fire. The rioters broke windows, looted stores, and set buildings, both abandoned and occupied, on fire. Firefighters quickly flooded the neighborhoods, and Chicago's off-duty firefighters were told they got to go to work. There were 35 major fires reported between 4 o'clock p.m. and 10 o'clock p.m. that day. Next day, Mayor Richard J. Daley imposed a curfew on anyone who was under the age of 21, closed the streets to automobile traffic, and halted the sale of guns and ammunition. Can't nobody buy no guns now. Approximately 10,500 police were sent in. By April 6, more than 6,700 Illinois National Guards troops had arrived in Chicago, with 5,000 regular Army soldiers from the 1st Airborne and 5th Infantry Division being ordered in the city by President Johnson. Sound like a war-torn city, doesn't it? But look, Baltimore, Maryland, same thing. The Baltimore riot of 1968 began 2 days after the murder. On Saturday, April 6th, the governor of Maryland, Spiro T. Agnew, called out thousands of National Guard troops and 500 Maryland State Police to quell the disturbance. When it was determined that the state forces could not control the riot, Agnew requested federal troops from President Lyndon Baines Johnson. The riots were precipitated by Dr. King's assassination, of course, but they were also evidence of the fact that there was long-time, large-scale frustration among the city's African-American population. Things were already boiling up. By Sunday evening, 5,000 paratrooper, combat engineers, and artillerymen of the 28th Airborne Corps and Fort Bragg, North Carolina, specially trained in tactics including sniper school, were on the streets of Baltimore with fixed bayonets and equipped with chemical dispenser backpacks. 2 days later, they were joined by the Light Infantry Brigade from Fort Benning, Georgia. With all the police and troops on the streets, the situation began to finally calm down. A general curfew was set at 6 p.m. in the city. Limits and martial law were enforced. As rioting continued, African-American plainclothes police officers and community leaders were sent in to the worst areas to try to keep things calm down. By the end of the summer of 1968, 7 people were dead and 4,000 injured, 3,000 arrested. Property damage was estimated to be about $5 million in that city. Sound like a war-torn country. Kansas City, Missouri, same thing going on. Riots in Kansas City did not erupt on the 4th of April like the other cities of the United States. However, by April 9th, after local events with the city, now this is an interesting thing right here. It wasn't directly the assassination itself, but listen to this. The riot was sparked by the Kansas City Police Department deploying tear gas against student protesters when they staged their performance outside of City Hall. Okay? The deployment of tear gas dispersed the protesters from the area. It worked. But other citizens were so aghast by this action that they too were mad and join those protesters. And what it resulted in was the arrest of 100 adults, left 5 people dead, 20 people admitted to the hospital. Detroit, Michigan, although not as large as the other cities, they're uprising. Violent disturbances did occur there. Michigan Governor George W. Romney, sounds familiar, doesn't it? Mitt Romney's daddy, ordered the National Guard into Detroit. One person was killed, and gangs tossed objects at cars and smashed storefront windows along 12th Street on the west side. Sound like these people pretty mad, man, and they ready to just tear up some stuff. But look at what happened in New York. Rioting erupted in New York the night Dr. King was murdered, with Harlem the largest African-American neighborhood in Manhattan, erupting in sporadic violence and looting. Tension simmered down after Mayor John Lindsay personally traveled in the heart of the areas that were most affected, and he expressed his personal regret for Dr. King's wrongful death. And that helped calm things down a little bit. But still, numerous businesses were looted and set on fire, both in Harlem and in Brooklyn. People mad. Sounds familiar? Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Disturbances erupted in Pittsburgh on April the 5th and continued through April the 11th. The riot peaked on April 7th, and when one person was killed and 3,600 National Guardsmen were sent in to the city. Over 100 businesses were either looted or burned in the Hill District, Homewood, and North Side neighborhoods, with various structures being set afire by arsonists. The riot left many of the city's black commercial districts in shambles. Interesting. Black commercial districts in shambles. And the areas most impacted by the unrest were slow to recover for decades, and in many of these cities, they still have not come back. Now they're being gentrified, and there's a new frustration. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. Listen to what happened in Avondale, Cincinnati. Tensions in the Avondale neighborhood had already been high due to the lack of job opportunities for African-American men. And the assassination only escalated this tension. Well, on April 8th, around 1,500 blacks attended a memorial at a local recreation center. Sounds simple enough. An officer of the Congress of Racial Equality blamed white Americans for Dr. King's death and urged that the crowd retaliate. The crowd was orderly when it left the memorial and spilled out into the street. They all in the streets now. Nearby, a fellow by the name of James Smith, who was a black man, attempted to protect a jewelry store from a robbery with his own shotgun. Black man trying to keep black folk from robbing his jewelry store. Okay? During the struggle with the robbers, however, Smith accidentally shot and killed his own wife. Now watch this. Riot started after the false statement was made in the crowd that Smith's wife was killed by one of the white police officers that was on the street. Rioters smashed stores, windows, and looted merchandise. More than 70 fires had been set, several of them major. During the rioting, 8 young African Americans dragged a white student by the name of Noel Wright. His wife was with him. Noel was stabbed to death and his wife was beaten. The next night, the city was put under curfew and nearly 1,500 National Guardsmen sent in so they can bring the violence down. Several days after the riot started, 2 people were dead, including Wright. Hundreds were arrested, and the city had suffered $3 million in property damage. Trenton, New Jersey. The riots were a major civil disturbance that took place during the week following the assassination of Dr. King. More than 200 Trenton businesses, mostly in the downtown area, were ransacked and burned. More than 300 people, most of them young black men, were arrested on charges ranging from assault and arson to looting and violating the mayor's emergency curfew. In addition to 16 injured police officers, 15 firefighters were treated at city hospitals for smoke inhalations, burns and sprains, and cuts suffered while they're trying to put the fire out. Denizens of Trenton's urban core often pulled fire alarms, and when they would do so and the firemen would come in, they would throw bricks at the firemen who responded to try to put the fire out. The losses incurred by the downtown business were initially estimated about $7 million, but the total of insurance claim settlements came to about $2.5 million. Williamton, Delaware. The two-day riot that occurred after Dr. King's assassination was small compared to riots in their in the other cities. But after, in the aftermath, a 9.5 month occupation by the National Guard. Can you imagine what that's like? During the riot, which occurred on April 9th through the 10th, 1968, the mayor asked for a small number of National Guardsmen to help restore order. Well, this Democratic governor, Charles L. Terry, who was a Southern hardcoat Democrat, sent in the entire state National Guard, and he refused. He refused to let them go for this period of time. Okay? 9 months they were there occupying that city like a police state. Can you imagine how upset the people were? Now, today, what's interesting is that we find young people facing some of the same type of situations. And when we think about one incident, we're going to have a gentleman from Ferguson, Missouri, which is another hotbed deal just in recent history. What we find is that these people still have this anxiety in the very neighborhoods that they tore up. They had to live in the stores that they shopped at and things of that nature. Well, right quickly, let's listen to what Marvin Gaye said in 1971 as he published this piece. Then we'll open up our phone line, 0944. Talk Straight. This is your host, Reverend Dr. Reuben Dockery. Tonight we ask the question, has urban America recovered from the Holy Week uprising of 1968? Our phone lines are open and we welcome you to give us a call here. 3072 and 1098, welcome to the discussion tonight.
Thank you.
All right. What do you think? 3072. Have we recovered?
No, I mean, we've made some strides, I think, but there's not been a full recovery, no. No, I don't think so.
You know, when you think about the neighborhoods that were damaged and pilgrimage in this period of time,
mm-hmm.
this 4th to 14th, 68, and 50 years later, some of those same places you go to now, those that are gentrified look a little different, but we don't live there no more,
yeah.
by and large.
Yeah.
You understand what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So who did we hurt? Who did we hurt by allowing our anger to get the best of us? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm wrong. But who did we hurt, 3072?
It looks like we just hurt ourselves. I mean, I don't see you being wrong. Right. The only person that's been negatively affected is us. I mean, that's, to me, a no-brainer. If you just look around, like you said, and after they gentrify those communities, the ones that have been brought up, and, you know, what do? They push those people out to other parts that is desolate and dead and negative. So then you have a whole nother cycle created there, you know. So we've hurt ourselves, you know, just keeping it real.
You know, and the truth is, we didn't bring any businesses back of our own. And so the quality of life for us economically, not very well. And then if you didn't have jobs in the city and what have you, and we heard that from some of the various cases, studies there, how in a lot of places people were mad already before King got killed. That just really gave
mm-hmm.
them a justification for sharing their pain, you know what I mean? And at
yeah.
the end of the day, we still got too many young men in particular unemployed, without any businesses or without any focus or direction, and they're in the streets. When you look at most of the incidents that happen with police engagement, it's in the streets. Why are they in the streets? 1098, are you with me?
Oh, yes, I'm here.
Can you help me with that, man? Why are brothers out in the streets so much? Why is it that seems to be the only way they can occupy their time?
Well, you know, they're basically interested in that thug life, fast dollar, things of that nature. I remember 1968 when Martin Luther King was killed. My mother, you know, my grandmother, she lived in Cleveland Home. That's on Vance, which owned a Vance low-rank motel. During that period of time, and Memphis didn't suffer too much damage. It was storefront when it was broken out downtown and things of that nature, but it wasn't too much damage done. But at the end of the day, you said it correctly. People are already angry. You know, they're already fired up, so it doesn't take too much of anything for them to attack and destroy. You know, and when you basically sometimes when you ask them why'd you attack and destroy, well, oh man, I just don't like white people. Well, you know, black businesses suffer also.
Man.
You know what I'm saying? You know, black businesses suffer also. In our reality, it is a setback. I was listening to a police officer. You know, he stated this, which you know we've been saying this all the time. If the police ask you to sit down, sit down. But see, that anger and animosity that they have built up in them just causes them to rebel and get you killed.
Can I add something to what you said? No, don't go anywhere. What I see 1098, these guys that are 14, 15, 16 years old, they're not even old enough to know what went on then. But they're reliving the anger and frustration of their fathers and grandfathers.
Exactly.
Where do we go wrong with that, man?
Inbred hatred is what it is.
Wow.
Inbred. You know, they talk about the white people teach their kids racism and prejudice and things of that nature. Well, blacks are guilty of the same thing. All races are guilty of the same thing at one point. I think at one point we covered these issues. But that's the truth. You know, I mean, slavery. I don't know anything about slavery. I didn't even know how it feel to be a slave, but I know slavery was wrong.
Right.
I know that much. And I know that eventually, you know, freedom was given to us, but when the freedom was given to us, what are we doing with it? robbing, stealing, killing each other.
Hurting one another.
On a massive scale, you know.
Wow.
On a massive scale.
Wow.
And, you know,
wow.
I don't, I'm not worried about the white man. I tell people daily, no, I don't worry about the white man doing nothing to me. It's my own kind.
I get
broken, too. I get robbed. You know, it's not white man. You know, I mean, police, you have good officers and bad officers. You know, there's no
sure
ifs and buts about
sure.
that. But,
sure
but as you stated, you have to have a beginning and you have to have an end. You know,
right.
when Martin Luther King came down to Memphis, you know, which he came twice, but when the first time he came, you know, those Negroes got violent and started breaking out, winning the thing, that nation, it was over. You know, he wasn't about violence, but you had those Negroes down there totally angry and started tearing up downtown. I was 10 years old when it happened. I remember.
Wow. Wow.
The whole Skaboo.
Okay.
I can even go back to when John F. Kennedy was killed. Little kid sitting up watching television, brothers and his dad, black and white television. Let me be quiet.
Yeah. Okay. We got Professor Robinson, looks like, with us. Welcome to the conversation.
Good evening. Good evening.
All right.
Good
questions,
evening.
Comments thus far?
Well, I wanted to piggyback on the comment that the gentleman just made. It said he doesn't fear the white man. It's more... you know, people that look like us. And I guess I want to touch on something you said. I understand the anger, but is our anger placed in the right, is it directed towards the right issues? Are we directing our anger in the right, you know, are we focusing on the right things?
No.
Right.
No. And that's explanatory, Professor. No, we're not.
Well, It's interesting you asked that
and
question.
What do
I
we need to do? Go ahead.
I'm sorry, Professor. Go ahead, finish the talk.
No, I was going to say, what do we need to do to change that focus? If we all understand that we're not focused on the right things, how do we identify those things and then say, this is what we need to focus on?
I'm so glad you asked that. I posed a question for Dr. King, and listen to what he said. Listen to what Dr. King said. All right, let's see, here we go.
Somewhere we must come to see that human progress never rolls in on the wheels of inevitability. It comes through the tireless efforts and the persistent work of dedicated individuals who are willing to be co-workers with God. And without this hard work, time itself becomes an ally of the primitive forces of social stagnation. So we must help time and realize that the time is always right to do right.
To do right. What about that, Professor?
The time is always right, but at the end, it still comes down to when are we going to seize upon the moment? Let me give an example. You mentioned Black Lives Matter. And I think that is a wonderful organization. However, I say they're focused on the wrong things.
Okay.
And so if we were able to harness that power, that energy, and target it towards some different outcomes, and I'm not even sure what the outcomes are, and I think that's another part of the issue. What are we trying to accomplish with all of this anger? And are we able to accomplish those things with this anger and protest and so on? I don't believe that we have clearly defined goals and strategies that link and tactics that will drive those outcomes.
Okay. I think your point is well taken. Go ahead, 37. Because I was going to ask you a question, 37. Go ahead. I'm glad you. Go ahead, speak.
Oh, well, I was just going to say about all this anger, you know, that's raging. I mean, it's okay to be saddened, or it's okay to be disappointed. It's okay to be angry, even. But I think, like the professor said, when you start to make that an everyday part of life, you wake up, you're just angry. You're focusing on the wrong thing. I mean, and I think over the course of time, and we had a right to be angry. However,
okay.
Black people now, or I ain't going to say black, let's just say our communities now are, to me, it's like piggybacking, right? So in 2018, young brother, what do you have to be angry about compared to those people back in the 60s, back in the 50s, back in the 70s even? Have anybody sprayed you with a damn water hose? Have anybody spit in your face and called you a nigger? Has anybody burnt a cross on, I mean, things like that is what I'm saying. So, right, what are you angry about, and what are you trying to accomplish? First, you need to find out why you're mad. What are you mad about?
Right. You know, I was going to ask you, this is Professor Mika, by the way, y'all. I was going to ask Professor Mika.
Yeah, that's right.
how much does it cost to get mad? How much
Nothing.
Do you have to put in to get mad?
Oh, I mean, no money, but to me it uses a whole lot of energy. I mean,
can you see that dynamic, Outkast? Four people
yes,
have
I see
at
it.
Their fingertips an abundance of the ability to get mad and tear stuff up because it don't cost them nothing.
Yeah.
Most of the time, if you don't own nothing, you feel like, it ain't mine anyway. I don't care.
Right.
You
yeah.
Right.
Can you
right.
see where that dangerous mentality is brewed? Especially if
yeah.
you're not willing to work for yourself
well,
have something.
Well, Pastor,
go ahead.
Pastor, there is a
Go ahead.
Cost. There is a cost. And that cost is, you know, how many new businesses are going to think about relocating into your area if this is,
exactly.
you know, something that could happen to them? So how many jobs are lost as a result of that? How many people who could bring their talents and treasures into that area are having second thoughts about that? So there is a loss.
Mm-hmm.
We just
mm-hmm.
don't quantify it. We don't help people to understand, you know, that it does cost. There is a cost associated with our actions, with our choices.
Wow.
Yeah.
Finally get.
Go ahead, Outkast. I'm sorry.
Maybe they'll get it. Let me state this. I don't knock anybody for what they believe in or whatever, but when it comes to Black Lives Matter, I feel like this, all lives matter. You know, like Martin Luther King stated, injustice done anywhere is injustice anywhere. White folks, some of the atrocities that was going on with the blacks when they was taking those young black boys, putting them in prison, putting them in work camps just to have bodies, you know, going back to the, you remember that time, don't you, Roman Dockery? When it was taking
during
them,
the
blacks, put,
encampment, you
yeah,
mean?
Yeah, yeah, putting them in prison, yeah. See, it was doing yeah. whites like that also.
Sure,
now,
sure.
When
sure.
it comes to lives, all lives
right.
matter. You know, when somebody else sneezes, black people catch that cold. See, when white folks sneeze, black folks catch a cold. You know,
right.
so you know me.
We get pneumonia.
Me hate
it double pneumonia.
Right. You know, me hating any color or shade of man. No, I try to treat any shade of color man the way that I want to be treated. You know,
okay.
If I had to save a white boy, yeah, I'm going to save him because perhaps that's going to help me. You know, hatred,
okay.
there's no room for that. Black Lives Matter, I detest it. And in God's name, I say all lives matter. What was Black Lives Matter when that stuff went on down there in Muffetboro? Oh, you saw a lot of white folk, but guess what? As I have been stating all the time, they had a sign that stated all lives matter. We need to get up off
yeah.
this black stuff. We don't just live in a black world. We live in a multicolored world. And this is what Martin Luther King was saying all the time. But what part of that message does the black people don't get it? And I hope. I'm getting kind
well,
of emotional. I hope.
I feel you. If I had an opportunity to speak to a Black Lives Matter enthusiast, I would try to reason with them that Noel Wright and his wife had done nothing to anybody. They were only victims of being in the wrong place in that city at the wrong time. And that gave nobody who was mad for whatever you were mad about a right to kill them, kill him or beat his wife. Mm-hmm. You understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But what happens is when your mind is so driven by anger and vitriol, you can't do as Professor was suggesting and be rational and even bring yourself out of a tough situation. One of the things about it is I'm going to tell you what's happening with a lot of the funds in these urban areas that are being gentrified. The vast majority of them, in fact, I would argue all of them, are using Title VI federal funds, part of the housing redevelopment, and they're using this to bring developers in. Well, when these developers come in, Professor, they're not trying to build no low-budget housing. They're trying to bring things that will generate money, wealth, income. Unfortunately, the people that have been there for generations still have not moved up on the ladder economically and oftentimes educationally, so they can't afford anymore to live in the new revitalized area. That's what Hope Six is really all about. So the money that they wrote grants for 30 years ago has finally come around, but the people that it was written in their names can't afford to live there anymore because of the way the government, the local government, use those funds. So if you ask me, rather than being mad, ready to fight, go educate yourself to who's representing you in office and why did they use the resources that were intended to help train you not only in workforce development, but entrepreneurial development, things of these nature, as well as job skills training. Why is it that they didn't use those funds in that way? And now here you are, you're pushed out because there's a new way that you can't afford it.
Keep talking straight.
I mean,
I hear you. Keep talking straight.
You know, Malcolm X talked about the ballot of the bullet. And in that year, just before he was killed, he said it's the year of the ballot of the bullet. There are a lot of cats right now, unfortunately, they are falling to the bullet because the last thing they know anything about is the electoral process and how to avail themselves in society as a citizen with a right. Basically, I love what Professor Robinson always talks about, and that is thinking about what you need, coming up with some kind of plan, and working your plan. Why do you think so many people don't do that, Professor?
Because it takes work, and it's also you have to deal with you. You really have to deal with you because you are the one who gets in the way.
Wow.
You are the one who, at the end of the day, the resources are there. And Pastor, you mentioned, you know, getting out to vote. Black people, you know, if you look at the Urban League, State of Urban League, see the Black America Report from the Urban League, Black people vote more than just about anybody else if you believe their numbers, and I believe their numbers. And so when we tell people to get out and vote, we get out and vote. The problem is we tend to, in large numbers, vote for the same party, and we don't hold these people accountable. And then we get the results that we get, and we wonder why. And other people, they are okay voting for this one or that one. At the end of the day, they're going to hold them accountable. And until we choose to do that, we're going to continue to get the results that we have. I moved to the Nashville area. I knew gentrification was happening. And I knew it was happening 20 years ago. And this was shared. It was shared with me. And it was shared with me that the leaders in the political leaders, the Black political leaders, they knew about this because these are conversations that took place at the city council. It had to take place at the city council. And why are we still surprised that these things are happening?
Keep talking straight. Pastor Waller has joined us. Welcome to the discussion, Pastor Waller. They throwing blows already, Pastor. You better tough.
No, but what the professor stated is true, you know, and I have to agree with everything that he stated, and I hold.
Yeah, he on the money now. He definitely on. Well, so then what do we do with the Black politicians that we've been voting for 1098? What do we do with them?
Like the professor said, hold them accountable, hold their feet to the fire. If they don't, you know, prevail, they don't do what they're asked to do, vote them out. Get rid of them. You know, they got a buddy-buddy system going on in that political arena anyway. Sons and daughters and all that old crap. You know, mamas and daughters, you know. I mean, come on, you know. This is why, you know, politics is where it is now. You know, I mean, if you look out through the United States, everywhere you basically you don't have a father and a son, the son going to come try to follow behind the father, and the son end up in the prison system. Buddy-buddy.
Wow.
Need to get away from that, you know. I mean, it started early on with the early presidents, you know, getting their family members, having them going all over there in England and going on. Come on, let me hold. I ain't going to get too far in the history.
Well, that's an interesting thing. Listen, I asked Dr. King what he thought about that. And I asked him what he think the proper perspective is. Now, interestingly enough, guys, it's been 50 years since he's been gone, but his voice is still alive today. Listen to what his perspective is on that, Pastor Wallace.
We are challenged to develop a world perspective. No individual can live alone. No nation can live alone. And anyone who feels that he can live alone is sleeping through a revolution. The world in which we live is geographically one. And the challenge that we face today is to make it one in terms of brotherhood. Now, it's true that the geographical oneness of this age has coming to be into a large extent through modern man's scientific ingenuity. Modern man, through his scientific genius, has been able to dwarf distance and place time in chains. And our jet planes have compressed into minutes distances that once took weeks and even months. All of this tells us that our world is a neighborhood. Through our scientific and technological genius, we have made of this world a neighborhood, and yet we have not had the ethical commitment to make of it a brotherhood. But somehow and in some way, we've got to do this. We must all learn to live together as brothers, or we will all perish together as fools.
Pastor Wallace, how do we get that talk to these young cats on the street, man?
Huh?
How do we get that teaching to these young cats? You run around there with a pistol. You think you can solve your problem by shooting everybody, but you'll perish one day like a fool.
Well, you know, one day that would occur, and as you said, you know, but it's the lack of knowledge, you know, where it says my people perish for the lack of knowledge, and that's the thing that they're crying. They're crying for knowledge, man. I don't know, you know, if you have to hear them cry out by way of a voice out of their mouth or their actions. It's a cry in action, and that's what I can identify with. Because it wasn't that I was crying out loud. I was crying inside, man. And so it's like information. Because you're saying, you know, gunning people down is something that's, I would say right now, it's a going thing. And you said something about the politicians and things. How do you check them? In other words, what is checking them going to do? What you going to do to check them? What is it that you're going to do to make them accountable? So the same thing with the people that's out there caught up, man, that's crying out. How do they become responsible, productive citizens of society without knowledge? It's impossible without knowledge. So, but with knowledge, then, you know, it's like my friend, for example, man, I didn't ever think I was going to get out of prison. And now you can't get him to even be in the atmosphere with that can on, you know, that's going on, man. And so sometimes it takes, you know, a little longer than others. But I just believe that they cry for information. We got to get the information out there where they are. If I didn't see it in the word, I wouldn't even make mention of it. But he says the harvest is plentiful. It's big. It's large.
Right.
You know, and that's evidence right there to say, okay, if you're not identifying yourself concerning the harvest, then all this other is like seeking sand. You know, and I mean, that's just the way it is. And everybody in their own little corner of the world, everybody don't have to be together and form up with you or with me or with anybody else, you know, that's talking right now. But just in your own little corner of the world, man, you'd be amazed.
Question.
Of the difference that it would make if
sure.
if people with knowledge would go out there.
Right.
I just believe that.
Right.
I have to believe that, Pastor. If I don't believe that, I'm in trouble. You see? Yeah, I'm in big trouble, man, if I don't believe that.
Can I ask a question? What's keeping the people with the knowledge from doing that today? Or doing it yesterday or the day before that? There are people with the knowledge today.
Uh-huh.
Hello? There are people who have the knowledge today.
Uh-huh.
Are there people with knowledge
and
today?
And my question is, what's keeping them from taking that knowledge and sharing it with others? What's getting in the way today? What's preventing them from doing
question,
that?
Pastor, you understand
the
question?
Yeah, just doing
okay.
Yeah, I understand it. Just doing it. They're doing it because, you know, faith without works is dead. A doer, that's what it is. It all boils down to a doer. You know, not just hearers only, but doers. So that's what it takes. You know, that's what it is with knowledge. If you got the knowledge, go do something with it. And that's what I would say.
Right, but I guess my question is, we've been saying just do it for a very, very long time. And people are still not doing it.
Let's just say some people are not doing it because that means if you put me in, that means I'm not doing it, and I'm out there in the midst of the guns. I'm in the midst of all the violence. I'm right in the midst of all of that as you and I speaking now. And I'm saying, not saying it to stop you from saying what you're saying. I just want to make sure that you know that some people are not doing it, but not all.
Yes,
that's what I do.
So you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah.
When we add up all of the current efforts, we're
mm-hmm.
falling short. I think everybody would agree. And so, what do we need to do to increase impact on a scale that will actually start to change outcomes?
Wow.
Yeah. And I love your approach because you're right on target, and that's where action come in at. God is a God of knowledge. Yeah, go ahead.
I won't answer that. Professor,
mm-hmm.
you got to start cleaning house. There are people literally in the way of progress. They think they look cute. They think they sharp, and they believe they're entitled to sit in the way of progress. And we need to clean house. Who is we?
We've cleaned house already.
Have we? I mean, help me with that, Professor.
Let's open it up for conversation. I say we have.
1098, have we cleaned house already?
Absolutely not. Because if we had already cleaned house, why is all this killing going on? Why are our babies going to get ready to go to penitentiary at 15 years old?
Wow.
Why is this? You know, why is it that an old lady can't walk down the street without getting mugged? Why is
this?
Yeah, man.
Come on.
You know?
Come on.
And the house is clean? No, the house is not clean.
No.
Martin Luther King was trying to clean the house up, but
mm-hmm.
as he stated, and I stated, and a lot of other people stated, people asleep that need to wake up. They need to wake up.
I'm.
And I hope.
And look, 1098.
Are these
all
people
done was
forced? Are they being forced
the
to sleep?
What'd you say, Professor?
I said, are these people being forced to sleep?
So here it is, Professor. Here's what the deal is. I'm gonna put it on Front Street, okay? I'm gonna drop it like it's hot.
Please.
Here's the deal. It's a psychological socialization that
mm-hmm.
you're rewarded for being helpless and relying on something or somebody else to do for you what you ought to do for yourself. Let me use an illustration.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
When you're a newborn baby, it's expected that somebody should get past the stink of your waste material. But when you get to be good, grown, and musty, nobody want to put their hand unless you really just totally indigent and can't do nothing for yourself. Can I get a witness, somebody?
Amen.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
Hey,
what we've learned to do more than anything else is to self-destruct. And anybody, any political party, any religious group that's encouraging you to be lazy, trifling, and not do for yourself, that is not your friend. What did I just
Amen.
I just said?
Wait a minute. So what political group is doing that? Are you suggesting that the Democratic group is doing
is that what you
said? Republican? All of it.
Democrat, Republican, Mickey Mouse party. Any party that tell you that you should not have your own agenda and that you not speak your own mind that is best
sure,
for you.
I
and
agree
your
with all that.
Okay,
I agree.
So what's your,
I agree with you. Yeah.
Okay.
So my question was, who do you suggest was doing that?
What I suggest is that you look at the party platform. If you belong to a party, you look at the party platform and you ask yourself, is that platform what I need? And if it ain't, you
mm-hmm.
make the decision. Excuse my English.
Okay.
If it's not, you make the
yeah.
choice. That's what I suggest.
Yeah.
I ain't trying to
yeah.
tell you what the mm-hmm. what party belongs to, but you need to look at it for yourself and say, is this for me or is it against me?
Right.
Did
yeah.
I go wrong with that, Pastor Wallace?
Well, it's the only thing we speak the truth, brother. I mean, that's what you have to be standing on. And that's the question that you is raising. Which party is doing that? And you say both just the party as a whole, because if they're doing it and they have motives, and this is the sad part about, you know, this type of relationship with the political parties, and when they step up, they want you to vote for them, and then after they get the vote, what do? Are they being held
yeah.
accountable? Which
no.
one it is, right? You know? And I think it's a sad situation because you may not have a concern from them being elected. Or maybe they're being controlled. I don't know what the case may be, but
right.
it's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing. 3072 is good to hear your voice, too. Just keep on.
You too. You too.
Yeah,
yes, sir.
Chop it up. You have us fighting hard. Pastor Doctor is a man that loves the political realm. I mean, he's one that, you know, if he had a position, I believe right now he would put his life online. You know, and I'm talking about this
no.
man here. I believe he would do that. 3072. I've been around him, and I mean, when I see, I believe he would do that. That's
yeah.
an understatement.
Pastor Waller, can I correct you? I don't love the political arena, but I recognize that as a citizen, I'm a member of that community, and I need to be involved if I'm not going to get left behind. It's an ugly job, but somebody got to do it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, man, I tip my head off to you.
It's a messy game, man. It's a messy game. Go ahead, Professor.
Pastor Dockery.
Yes, sir.
I'm going to go back to my question about, or my stance that we've been cleaning house. There are new politicians going in all of the time, correct?
Uh-huh.
New leaders.
Uh-huh.
And so there isn't any one leader that has been there forever. There are new people that continue to go in, and we are making those decisions as it relates to who goes in. And so the ones who are turning out to vote, the ones who are casting their votes, the ones who are involved and engaged, whatever that is, I think for the tax hike, it was like 3% of the people came out to vote or whatever the number was. I don't even remember what that was, the sales tax hike here. But at the end of the day, we are making a decision either by not participating or how we participate.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And so it's still up to us.
I agree. I couldn't agree with you more. That's why I say we haven't cleaned house, Professor, because we have not collectively brought our voice nor our strength together to affect what we want. Now, what I noticed about the gay, lesbian, transgender community, just a few years ago when they really came out, guess what they did? They came out, and they were organized. They were organized, and they put enough pressure where it needed to be to advance certain policies on their behalf. I'm not saying I agree with those apologies or disagree with them. My point is that Negro, black, and colored folk been in America for 400-some years. And we've been free to vote for about 152 years now. I'm with you, Professor.
Well,
when we're going to use that?
Well,
go ahead,
I was going to support what Pastor Waller was saying about, okay, so we are putting those people, we're trusting them. They fooled us and tricked us like, hey, okay, I'm for you guys and I'm going to make changes and all that. Right, and they get in office and then what? They fail to do what we voted for them to do essentially. So then in that case, that discourages people from continuing to vote.
Right.
It makes them lose faith and, you know, like,
right.
forget it. So it's
that's
like...
Right.
With that being said, Reuben Dockery, you were saying about, like, cleaning house. So, I mean, how do you know what you're putting in there? You elect somebody else, it's the same thing.
Okay.
It's the same
thing. Trial and error.
Yeah.
Watch out.
Yeah.
What do you say, 1098, trial and error? Here's the thing. Here's the thing. That was a time, I think what we have to do is we have to look at it from a historical perspective too, guys, because there was a time where there were classic examples of success models and people doing well. In fact, today, the wealthiest, particularly African Americans, they're successful because they embrace certain values and they use those in their day-to-day decision making, including their political participation. And when the masses of people, all these cities that I talked about today that were in turmoil and black males in the streets, angry, mad as all get up and looking for a fight. We're going to talk about one of those cities in recent times now. Next week we hope to have those two guests on from St. Louis. But I'm just saying, I'm making the point that until those people wake up, 3072, and realize that there is an appropriate way or a successful model. Help me with this, Professor Robinson. There's a successful model that successful people use. Did I say that right, Professor?
Yeah, and one of the things that at some point we will get to, it's defining things in terms that we can assign, you know, goals to. And so when we say wake up, I have no idea what that means. and so that can mean anything to a bunch of different people. And so what are we really asking people to do and how are we helping to enable those actions, those positive actions that are going to drive more positive outcomes in our communities?
Absolutely. I don't know if you're watching on Facebook or not, but behind me there's a sign that talks about change in 2018. If we ever needed it before 1098, we need it today. Because what's been happening hadn't served us well at all. We need some need to change.
Exactly.
I mean, let's
want to piggyback on what Professor said when she said, how do
Professor
we know until...
Okay, go ahead.
Well, Professor Meeker said, how do we know? And so how do we, you know, what filters, what politicians promise the world with very little specificity, and people buy this bill of goods, and at the end of the day, some deliver, some don't. And so how do we help people to make sure that they know what they're asking for and they are real specific with that
so that they can know if it's being realized or not.
Right. Right. Can I say something?
Isn't politics just a game? I mean, it's really, it's just a game. It's a game.
Life is a game.
It's a game.
Life is
I'm
a
sorry.
Game.
It's a game.
Life is a game, Professor Mika.
Wow. I mean, what am I going to vote for somebody to increase the food stamp amount, increase the link card to two? I mean, what? Right. Like you said, what are you asking for? What?
You raise a
what?
You raise a great question. I'll use an example. In the state of Tennessee, in this particular Senate district that I live in, over $1.2 billion, with a B, has been allocated for state funding over the last four-year cycle. Okay?
Wow.
But yet we still have children who are woefully failing in the public school system.
Yeah.
We still have dire poverty in most of the voting precincts that are involved. We still have high crime, and we still have significant numbers of health disparities. All that money was spent to address those things. But the people that needed to hold the politicians accountable through their vote and watching them, not just during election time all year long, where were they at? What were they doing? The monies were spent.
Sure.
Somebody got it. Somebody got it.
We need to get an itemized list on what they spent it on. Where's the list of what they spent it on?
So you're educated about what you need, how to leverage access to those things, but more importantly, how to use them so that they are of benefit to you, the more empowered you are to hold every and anybody accountable, starting with yourself. See, Professor Robinson, If I'm not going to hit myself upside the head with a hammer, I'd be darned if I let you hit me with it, if I know about it anyway. You know what I mean?
If I could just say one thing real quickly, we shouldn't ask them what did they spend or look for an itemized list. We are going to tell them that there's a big difference. There are people telling them what to do today. And they've been telling them what to do for a very, very long time. I'm in the telling mode, not the asking mode.
Yeah.
Well, and I only said that to know, like he just pointed out, some people don't know there was that much money allocated for things. So, okay, if it was there, what did they buy? So I'll know the next time what I don't want them to shop for. Here's what I want you to get.
But more importantly,
here's what I want you to get.
No, what,
go ahead, Professor. I think you're gonna say the same thing.
The difference is in the mindset, the approach, and the control. Do you want to control the decisions, or are you being impacted by those decisions? And so the people who are telling them what to spend. Well, one second, please. The people who are telling them what to spend it on, they already know what the budget is. They determined what the budget is. They're not finding out on the back end. They're controlling it. There's a big difference between controlling the decisions, demanding that the decisions follow your specific needs and wants, versus on the back end saying, let's find out where this money was spent. It's a very, very big difference, and we have to understand that.
Does that make sense, Mika?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense, but still, you still need to be in the know, to me, of what's going on. I mean, I need to know what I need to. Yeah, that's all.
What he's saying does
make sense.
What he's saying, don't come to the knowledge after the fact.
Right.
Be there on the front end. For instance, it's a certain time of the year, every year, that there are discussions about what the fiscal budget is going to look like for the next year.
Okay.
Now,
okay.
If your elected representative is not having conversation with you on your precinct about what's coming up in the budget, what do you need in your precinct? Because your precinct is made up certain neighborhoods, the one you live in.
Right.
What do you all need? And what is it that you want me to advocate for on your behalf in the budgetary process? Does that make sense? As opposed to waiting until after it's done, say, well, why you didn't put that in there? Or we needed this, or we should have had so-and-so, so-and-so. Well, if you were involved,
right,
part of holding them accountable is is to watch them. For instance, school. The state of Tennessee have what they call the Tennessee Blue Book, and it's basically all of the standards, the benchmarks, and measurements for what a child should learn from kindergarten through 12th grade. Well, as a parent, if you're not aware of what your teacher should be teaching your child in first grade within the first marking period, you don't know how to hold a teacher accountable. I'm not saying you have to be a professional educator, but at least be aware of what they're supposed to be doing.
Right.
Does that make
sense? Right. Yes.
And so as we speak about recovering from Holy Week, I'm concerned, Pastor Waller, that all of the damage and all the carnage that existed, some of it is being cleaned up now, but we won't benefit from the new cleaned area because it's being gentrified in such a way that we can't afford, many people can't afford to live in, who was there for generations.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Pastor.
Go ahead.
All right, so let me squeeze this last one in here from Dr. King, and then I want to pose a question to you. Thursday, I'm going to share with you, starting from 1921 up to 2018, a number of different expressions of anger and anxiety. And I want you all to tell me who it is that we're talking about. Not all of them were black people, but the point here is, after Thursday, we're going to be looking at some examples of proactive measures and some positive things that we can grow from. It's important that young people understand that no matter how bad things were yesterday, you're in control of today and tomorrow. We can't bring back yesterday, but what you do today will invariably determine what your status will be tomorrow. But just give me 1 second, and then we'll come back.
One of the great liabilities of life is that all too many people find themselves living amid a great period of social change, and yet they fail to develop the new attitude, the new mental responses that the new situation demands. And they end up sleeping through a revolution. That can be no game.
I'm going to stop him right there, Pastor Waller. He just said something right there. When y'all going to wake up? That's my question. When y'all going to wake up? I'm going to stop it right there, Outcast. When y'all going to wake up, man? Somebody help me with that.
But that's not a bad question. That's not a bad question at all.
Go ahead. Come on, talk to me, somebody.
Professor? Come on, Professor.
I'm going to go back to how do we define people being awake. And once we can define what that looks like, then we can start to put together the strategies and the tactics to make that happen. And so what does, when you say awake, what does that look like?
Great question.
Being rational. Let me see if I can stick that. Being rational instead of irrational.
Mm.
Being rational in the sense that you want to look in the mirror, you want to get up, and you want to make a positive change, heading in the right direction, not heading in a irrational state of violence and things of that nature. Being rational in the sense of trying to become an entrepreneur or trying to help someone else become an entrepreneur. Even though, you know, we come into the world, Chabot Russell, you know, a blank slate, and we learn through senses and things of that nature, still, it goes back to being asleep. I would go as far as saying that being asleep is still a form of being tabula rasa, you know. And I hope.
Well, anytime you're awake.
Well, how do I measure?
Okay.
And I want to be able to measure so we can see how we're we're progressing towards that goal? How do I measure being rational? What are some of the tangible things that we can observe?
Okay. I was just going to say, add to what Professor Outcast said in terms of being awake. One of the characteristics of knowing that you're awake is that you are alert and you have the ability to respond immediately because of your alertness. Now, in terms of measuring how well you alert, there are four characteristics of a living being. One of them has to do with the ability to respond to pressure, to threat, okay, and change and make a difference. Now, if you're in a situation where somebody's sticking you with a pin in your foot and you don't even know you're being stuck, it's a good chance that your foot is asleep. Your cells are dead. You probably got diabetes or something, and it's done kill all the cells in your foot. But when it's alive, you have the ability to be irritable, to be uncomfortable, and that uncomfortability will make you change your position. Are you walking with me now, Professor? That's how you measure.
I'm walking. I don't know if I'm with you right yet because
I'm going to go this way. I'm going to go this way. In education, here's how you know if a student has learned. Learning is measured with a change in the student's behavior after they've received instruction. That's how you measure learning. You start to find out what their behavior pattern is prior to. You evaluate that, provide your instruction. Then you go back to assess how well have they moved from where they were in that prior behavior after the instruction. And if you notice they haven't moved any further, only moved one or two steps, you know you need to go back and reteach again. That makes sense to you?
Okay.
So learning is
so a possible measure could be, I know that people are awake when the – I'm going to use this term, black-on-black crime rate goes from X to Y by this date.
Amen.
So that's a way that I can measure that people are awake.
That's certainly a measurement tool. Yes, sir. Or if you take a young man who's jobless and you put him through a process and he began to run his own business and he's making loot legally, that's a good measurement right there.
Okay, sir. So the business development rate within the community has gone from X to Y over this time period.
Correct. Now we have measurement tools, and we can develop ourselves a rubric, right? I say I'm sick, and I can't get up and move, but you treat me over a period of time, and now I'm able to stand up on my own, and I'm able to be viable and get about. That's a good measurement that I've gotten well. Now, ain't nothing you can do about me being ugly, Professor Robinson. I'm just going to have to deal with that. I've been that way all my life.
There's surgeries available. Yeah, that's a big industry. That is a very, very the fountain of youth. The pursuit for the fountain of youth is billions and billions of dollars.
Don't let his wife hear you insulting his look now.
Wow. Pastor Waller, what are you doing with the time, man? You were even gone for a while working this, and you come back and playing with the time. My goodness. We got about five and a half minutes here, guys, before we have to get out of here. Wow, man, good conversation. I want to believe that there's hope for us, but I gotta go with Professor Robinson. If we're not honest about wanting to change and then measure the success of our change or our progress, you're gonna be in the same state. I don't want to put that on nobody, but that just seemed to be the way it is. Let's get some final thoughts before we get out of here, and we'll let Pastor Waller wrap us up here. 3072, what about it?
I disagree with what everybody was saying. Yeah, we need to just pay more attention and do documentation on where we've come from and where we are and where we're looking to go.
We got to get that to our babies, don't we, 72?
Yes, yes, yes.
That was spoken just like a professor would speak right there, 3072. I like that. 1098, what do you say about it?
Well, they do a whole lot of pork spending, but as you stated, you know, you still have children that are hungry. So, I mean, none of the pork is coming that way, no.
Yeah. All right, well, appreciate that. Any final thought there, Professor, before we get ready to get out of here?
I'm going to piggyback on what Professor Mika said when she said it's a game, and it really is a game. Just have to understand the rules. And decide if you want to play by the rules or not. It is a game, and there are rules. There are established rules that we can follow.
Okay. Wow. Okay, Pastor Walt, you there?
Yes,
Pastor Walt, you there? All right, go ahead. We've about 3 minutes here. Give us a final thought.
Yeah, I'd like to say we thank everyone. And, again, I know the question was asked about being asleep and where are they asleep at, and I would be the first to say is in the Bible, according to now is high time to awake out of sleep. And I think he's talking to the people that's holding those Bibles, that's looking at the words in there and sleep while looking at them. And that's what it is. It's high time to awake out of sleep. Yes, it's that time. It's not just time to wake up, it's high time. So, you know, if you got the Bible and you see it in there, it's talking to you. And if not, we need to get it out there and tell the people that it's in there. And that is my encouragement to you.
All right.
Thanks again.
Well, we appreciate you. I know you were busy tonight, and I appreciate you tapping in with us there. We'll be back Thursday
all
night.
Right.
You've been listening to Talk Straight. We've talked from the topic, Has Urban America Recovered from Holy Week 1968? We'll pick up a similar related topic on Thursday before we have our two guests in from St. Louis, and they're going to share with us some very positive, proactive things that they're doing there. There's a fellow here in Nashville, Bishop Campbell. I like some of the things he's doing. We're going to ask him if he would come and join us here and talk to us about his little program here locally in Nashville, the city that we're based in here. But we appreciate you. This is Talk Straight, sponsored by Building Families and Communities Institute. We can be found on the web at www.bfcinstitute.com. Hope you go there and learn more about us, and most importantly, make a tax-deductible contribution to our cause and enable us to continue to travel to our targeted cities. And we'll come back and tell you a little bit more about some of those that we've done. Interestingly enough, right quickly, when I was working in Columbus, Mississippi, with the police department there, with the chief, we talked about these things and just about how different police departments have to be aware and cognizant of the fact that people are already on edge, and even though you're there to protect and serve, you have to make sure that they don't see you as a part of the problem, but part of the community there. So with that being said, join us here at 7 o'clock on Thursday night, right here on another episode of Talk Straight. We thank Professor Robinson, Mika, and Outcast, and Pastor Waller for coming and joining us, and we'll be back again at 7 o'clock on this coming Thursday. This is your host, Reverend Dockery, signing off.
Wake up, everybody, no more sleeping in bed. No more back to thinking, time for thinking ahead. The world has changed so very much from what it used to be. There's so much hatred, war and poverty. Oh, wake up all the teachers. Time to teach a new way. Maybe then they'll listen.